Hi, it's Haley. Thanks for tuning in to How We'll Live. Each week, I share conversations with people who are putting their passions into practice in meaningful and impactful ways. I talk with innovators, creators, scientists, researchers, and doctors. They're people who inspire me to want to be better, to keep learning and expanding my beliefs. If you like what you hear each week, I would love if you rated, left a review, subscribed, or shared with a friend. Your reviews help me make this show better because they tell me what you like and how I could make improvements. To stay up to date on what's coming up next, you can subscribe to my newsletter at haley-miller.com or follow me on Instagram at thehaleydaily. I'm really excited for you to hear from today's guest. If you're anything like me, more often than not, you head to the grocery store and pick up your favorite items without really thinking about where or who it came from. Food security is an issue for many around the world, and the changing climate and unpredictable weather patterns are making food yield predictability increasingly challenging. So what does this mean? It means that job security for farmers who rely on predictability and the ability to grow food is decreasing. Imagine a farmer with nothing to eat for themselves. Today's guest, Satya Raghu Mokapati, was formerly an accountant and saw this issue happening in his own village in India. He knew something had to be done. He and his co-founder started their company, Kati, which designs, adapts, and implements low-cost farming solutions that help small farmers increase yield and predictability of produce. Their greenhouse in a box uses technology and is an affordable modular greenhouse bundled with full-stack services that use 90% less water, grow 7 times more food, and give farmers a dependable income. It was such a pleasure speaking with Satya, and I think you'll agree. Okay, let's get to our chat. I'm really excited to sit down, learn about the organization, and you know, hopefully there will be ways that we can help you spread the word about all the great work that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that we're doing it because what we're doing and the way we're doing it, I wish more people get to know about it, not just to learn, but also to give us feedback and make us do what we're doing better.
Why don't you tell everybody listening, because I know that I won't do it justice if I try, what it is that you do, that your company does.
Sure. So we at Kati work for increasing the profits of smallholder farmers to start with India and of course, then to the rest of the world. Now, how do we do that? We get these smallholder farmers a tool called greenhouse and we bundle farm services around it. This greenhouse bundled with farm services will make sure that farmers earn money, which will keep them above poverty. Now you may wonder, well, greenhouses have been in the world for so long. Of course, yes, in the developed world, yes, greenhouses have been there for decades and decades of time. But the fact of the matter is that these greenhouses, which actually work and which create environmental protection, are not available and were never accessible to smallholder farmers. So what we've done is we made these greenhouses small, modular, and affordable. And by doing that, and also bundling the greenhouse with farm services, we are able to help farmers earn reliably, dependably, $100 a month. So the variability in income and the climate risk, which was a kind of causing it, we are able to cut that down and get like a reliable, dependable $100 per month of free disposable cash flow for the farmers.
Wow. How did you get that idea? Where did it come from? Did you have some kind of aha moment? And at what point in your life was that?
Great question. So since 2011, I've been in agriculture. First, with my co-founder Ayush, I started off as a farmer, and we started farming in a state in India called as Karnataka. And we actually realized how insanely tough this whole damn thing called farming is when we actually started doing it ourselves. And that was a point in time when we were wondering, what is that we can do well and what is that we can do as a service to the smallholder farmers? So we started off with market linkage service for the smallholder farmers who were growing grains and vegetables. But soon what we realized after about 3 years into our journey is while we were in terms of numbers, working with about 8,000 farmers, really, if we talk about the impact, what we were creating on those farmers, we were really unsure of that. And that is something which was unsettling me personally, that really made me feel restless. So that was the point in time when I got selected for Acumen Fellowship. And during my fellowship, there was a session on impact assessment. One of the points which I learned as a part of this fellowship was about the depth of the impact and the breadth of impact. I was kind of new to that world. When I thought about it, so the depth of the impact is really how significant is your impact on the people that you're working for, and the breadth of impact is just the number of people. So what I felt is I'm a person who probably cares more about the depth of impact than just the numbers. I probably might be happier if I die as a person who worked with 10,000 people, really made a significant change in their lives, than a person who worked with 10 million people and just did something very superficial in their life. So that was the kind of self-realization which I got to. And that was a point in time when I met one of my co-founders, Kaushik, and he was going through a sort of a quarter-life crisis like what I was going through in his journey. So he was doing rural skill development in, literally godforsaken places in India. And he was equally unhappy with the impact what just training was creating on the rural school dropouts. So I kind of just called him and said, hey, why don't we just catch up and talk about something that's kind of going on in my mind about the work that I'm doing. And Kaushik said, sure. But interestingly, before meeting me also, Kaushik had some understanding of the rural technologies and what can work for farmers. So when we started talking, in the very first 15 minutes, we clicked. And he said, Satya, let's work together if it's about something relating to agriculture and smallholder farmers. Then we spent the next 6 months listening to those voices of farmers, which were often unheard. We actually went and met at least 1,000 farmers, maybe over 100 villages, and had long conversations with them to understand what's really going on in their lives, what's hurting them the most, and what their aspirations are. That, to us, was super insightful. That, to us, defined the direction that Kheti should take. The farmers spoke about incomes being less. Farmers spoke about incomes being variable. And farmers spoke about incomes being lumpy, once in 6 months, once in 8 months. And the reasons why these incomes became risky are largely around water, are largely around climate risk. So we started thinking, how can we get farmers reliable, dependable income? So that got us thinking. So that's the thing from which we started back working. So we said, vegetables probably can give farmers a regular income. But vegetables in open field farming are still open and exposed to environmental risks. Mm-hmm. So then we thought we should just cover this up with a greenhouse. And well, greenhouses were super expensive. So we started researching on greenhouses and collaborating with different organizations across the world to get to a model which is modular and affordable. So, but if we just skip technology, it's good. But technology alone is not enough for smallholder farmers, because farmers face roadblocks at the end of every bend. Technology is good, but seeds, inputs, financing, everything is a point where the system could break. So that is when we had to integrate a bunch of these farm services with the greenhouse to make the technology work.
Wow. It's amazing thinking about going from idea to execution and how that idea evolves over time and how new roadblocks can constantly pop up, right? You're like, oh, let's focus on agriculture and use technology. And you're like, wait, but we have to grow certain types of crops to solve this problem. And then a new problem pops up. And I think what you said about having this passion or something within you that made you care about the depth of impact is a really profound thing. I think that something that we're all striving for is to have work that feels purposeful mm-hmm. and work that provides us with fulfillment. But your path wasn't always in this altruistic model, right? If, correct me if I'm wrong, but did you work as an accountant beforehand?
Yeah. So I was, I'm a CPA equivalent from India. And I worked with PricewaterhouseCoopers for about 3.5 years before moving out to start my journey in accounting.
Great. What triggered you to say, I am done with accounting, I'm done with these numbers, I want to focus on agriculture? Was there something that you saw or something that you did that sort of lit that excitement and passion up inside you?
Quite honestly, I had like an extraordinary time at PwC. So I was doing more of financial advisory stuff, fundraising, you know, kind of IPOs and QIP placements and stuff like that. So it was super exciting. But there was something which happened when I was, I think, 17 years old, which was the reason why I actually do what I do today. I was in my village playing cricket. You know, in India, almost everybody plays no other game except the game of cricket. So I was...
what is cricket? How do you play?
Yeah, so cricket is a game with 11 players on each side.
Okay.
And, I think it's kind of, as I understand, the second most popular game, if I'm not wrong.
So. In the world?
Oh, yes. Oh. So, you know, with...
Is it popular in the UK too?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It's just not here.
It's not popular in the US. No, yeah. I think it's just catching up in the US.
Okay. Right. Well, now that you're here, you can start a cricket league.
No. So, I was playing in the fields of my village. And I think I just played for like 2-3 hours already by then, and I was feeling slightly famished, and I was thinking if I could just grab a tomato or a banana, then I could kind of continue playing for some more time. So at a distance, I saw a farmer sitting and eating something. So I guessed that it would be a fruit or a vegetable, and you know, in villages it's a norm that if you just go and ask a farmer would willingly give. They wouldn't charge you money. So I kind of just went and I wanted to ask that farmer. So he must be like about 70 years old, you know, lean built. He just wore a white kurta and a turban. I was so shocked that he was actually eating mud.
Mud?
He was eating mud. I just went mad. I just yelled at him. Shouted at him, like, what is this stupid mud eating business? How can you eat mud? And I think I was a badass teenager who didn't really understand at that point in time why he was eating that, but I just still asked him, why the hell are you eating mud? He kept telling something, to be very honest, I don't remember the exact words for most of what he said, but there is one sentence which he said, my stomach doesn't know that my pocket is empty. He was sitting next to a farm stream, basically a stream through which water passes for irrigating the lands. That creates a soft mud. So he just ate that. And how can somebody say that their stomach is empty and their stomach is hungry and their pocket is empty? And how can mud even be an option for people to eat? I remember that I just ran away from the place. I was super afraid of what I saw. It was a shock.
I can imagine. I mean, that happening in your village, and then it becomes apparent to you that that's happening to someone, let alone a farmer who you think would have access to food.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody who grows food is the one who is eating mud.
Yeah.
I took a couple of days to recover from that shock. I don't think I really spoke to anyone for 2 days. And 2 days later, I went to my grandfather who is a freedom fighter. Who was a freedom fighter, and he was with Mahatma Gandhi during freedom struggle. And I just told him, I said, I saw something like this. I'm utterly disappointed. And after listening to me for maybe 5 to 10 minutes, non-stop, my grandfather just hugged me and said, do you think that he's the first one eating mud? I asked, what do you mean by that? He said, he started narrating actually. how during the Bengal famine that happened in India, mid of 20th century, how there were millions of people doing that. And he started narrating recipes with mud. He said, I saw people eating mud with yogurt. I saw people eating mud with rice starch. That was the point I thought, that when I think from bad I went to worse. I thought, this is just not done. How can this be a norm? I thought I saw something which was an exception. Now, this man is telling me that it's a norm. A lot of people do that. I didn't understand why. And I was really, really keen to know the root cause. And I think I spent, while I was working in PwC, I wasn't reading business journals. I wasn't reading accounting books for most part of my workdays. I was actually reading books about agriculture to understand the root cause of what was going wrong. So even though I was kind of doing well in my accounting in PwC, that incident was so irreconcilable that whenever I felt good about my work, that also kept coming back to me, and I just felt, why am I not doing something about it? And initially I thought maybe I should do something about it after I kind of earn enough money in life, maybe like in mid-40s, I should start something like this. But then I realized, who knows who will be alive till which day? So yeah. I don't want to have a regret if I die tomorrow. I frankly don't have a regret even if I die tomorrow. Because the time that I have, I should spend for stuff which I care the most about. Mm-hmm. And that really got me out of my chair, and I said, I want to start.
Wow. That's a really moving story. And I can't imagine that feeling, but you do such a great job explaining it. It's obviously something that had a huge impact on you. And I mean, it led you down this path where you're making change for so many people. I read this quote that you said, and I think maybe I wrote it down incorrectly, but stop being interesting and start being interested.
Yeah. So let me be honest. That's not my quote.
Oh.
So I heard from Jacqueline Novogratz, who is the founder of Acumen, but actually the source of this quote is from John Gartner, who actually said this. It resonates a lot.
Yeah. I think that quote speaks or aligns very directly with your story, sort of this aha moment, this moving time that you had when you were just a teenager. What was your village like growing up?
Well, I was born in a town which was, pretty much like a village.
Okay.
And that's my dad's place. And my mom's family lived in a village, true village.
Okay.
Which had like farmers having lands of about 2 acres, 3 acres, and so on. And I saw a lot of water being used for farming. I really never understood why during that time, like every day you just see like, oh God, so just there's like water everywhere. So, and I actually studied in Hyderabad. It's a city, but my summers and all my breaks, you call it spring break, winter break, all those breaks were pretty much back in the village. So yeah, I think my village is something very close to my heart. And I saw these farmers, pretty much everybody was happy. That's something that's also interesting. So they were generally happy, even though I saw that. That exceptional incident, which is people eating mud. People were generally happy. People were generally loving. People were generally caring. And there is always, they always found reasons to celebrate. They always found reasons to come together. So it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Wow, that's really amazing, isn't it? Because you look at so many other places or societies and cultures around the world. I mean, I find very much in living in New York City, a lot of our happiness, we think, is based around money.
Mm.
But there's so much joy in just being with people and celebrating life and what we do have instead of thinking about all the things that we don't have.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a lot of these farmers, there's a lot more things that they don't have. So when you and your co-founder started your discovery phase and talking to the farmers, you said you talked to probably nearly 1,000 farmers mm-hmm. in 6 months. What were they telling you?
Repeatedly, we learned that the water is drying up. Year after year, the water levels were going down. So that is one. The second one is the farmers kept saying that heat is getting worse and worse and we are finding it more difficult to work. So I tried my best to understand if it was just because the farmers were growing old or if they actually find, something changing in the environment. So while they couldn't nail down and say, hey, it's because of climate change, a lot of things what they kind of spoke about can directly be linked to climate change. So the water level drying up, heat increasing, and monsoons becoming erratic, and so on. So this has an implication of if heat goes up, the pest problem and disease problem in the agriculture goes up. So it kind of, this is all interlinked. So that way, the farmers kept talking about different factors. And he said, okay, for sure. So you don't have rains. So what? Okay, there's a pest problem. So what? So everything was hitting them at a point where their income levels were becoming more and more erratic. And your job doesn't pay you money in a reliable or a dependable manner. When your job doesn't pay you money in a reliable or a dependable manner, just imagine, you get $1,000 this month. Next month, you get $5,000, then $200. Would you do that job? No, right? So, I mean, it's way too erratic. You just can't imagine how that life looks, right? So that's exactly what these farmers were talking about. Unpredictability of agriculture.
And, out of their control.
Oh, yes.
Right? You know, it's different when I make a different amount of money every month and it's controllable variables. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about climate change and water pollution and water being a finite resource that we treat as if, you know, it shouldn't cost money, mm-hmm. you know, it's crazy to think about that. And I can only imagine the impact that it's having on people who rely on that as a source of income.
Yeah. In fact, we were just asking them with every problem that they stated. So who do you think should solve this? What should the solution be? So this is one of the questions we just kept asking them. So there were quite a few farmers jokingly, but quite seriously said, God. God is the one who should solve these problems. And well,
that would be nice, wouldn't it?
So we actually started thinking, sure, is there anyone other than God who can really solve these problems? Because you know, when the water dries up, they can't think of anyone else who can solve the problem. When heat increases, farmers can't think of anyone else who can solve the problem. So what we thought of doing is not, I mean, I don't want to say that we actually became a God, but we said, hey, I can't be a God for your entire farm, but I probably can do something to protect a small piece of your land, like maybe 2% of your land, size of a basketball court, right? So a small piece of land, how can we protect that from climate risk? How can we use, you know, very less water? So it's just like about, you know, it's a small drum of water per day versus some 1,000 drums per day what the farmers would have otherwise used. So how can farmers use very less water and actually grow profitably? So that's the kind of thing we started thinking of later.
Wow. Because I guess as the world gets hotter or more mm-hmm. unpredictable, I guess, you know, one second it's warm here and the next minute it's freezing cold and then I start getting sick and I'm like, what's happening? I don't even know. The yields change too, right? Yeah. So you don't even know what to expect in terms of what you're growing. So do the greenhouses provide them with a sense of predictability in the crops that they're growing, as well as the yields they can expect to return and their cost of like the water? Like they know that there's a controlled temperature, and I have no idea how these greenhouses work, so we should talk about that in a second too. But say a controlled temperature within the greenhouse, so I know how much water I'll use. It's almost like creating a very good business plan.
All right. So If you understand what a greenhouse exactly does, you will get an answer to this question. So what exactly is a greenhouse?
I don't know. I'm relying on you here.
So imagine there's a basketball court and it's kind of covered with something like a mosquito net on all sides.
Okay.
But that is called insect net, which is far more sophisticated, especially in terms of UV filtration and all of that. And it's covered on all sides and it uses steel to, kind of get strength for it to kind of stand and house plants. So this greenhouse essentially allows plants to grow vertically. So when plants grow vertically and the right kind of seeds, etc. are used, the yields increase 7x. So that's the kind of increase in the production for what farmers see by using greenhouse. And in terms of water usage, in open field farming, to grow same amount of vegetables, if farmers use 50 liters of water inside this greenhouse, they just need to use 1 liter of water. Right, so that's significant.
Wow.
That's significant. Where is 50 and where is 1? Right? So that is magic. So plants give more crop with significantly less water. So that is what makes, greenhouse a specialty for farmers. And they largely grow vegetables and fruits.
Wow. And your greenhouses are much smaller and less expensive, right? Than a traditional greenhouse. Did you do that intentionally for a very specific reason?
Yeah. So as I said at the beginning of the discussion, greenhouses have been in the world for decades and maybe even a century, I'll not be surprised. But the reason why they were inaccessible to smallholder farmers is because in India, if you want to build a greenhouse in 1 acre of land, it almost costs you about $60,000 to $65,000. Now, a farmer who is barely making $100 a month.
A month?
Yeah. How on earth would they ever get to buy? I'm talking about smallholder farmers. Mm-hmm. How on earth would they ever get access to buying an asset which is worth $65,000? So what we had to think about is, how can we make an asset which creates income which will keep them above poverty? Maybe they just don't want a ton of money. Even this amount, how much they want, we went back to the farmers and asked, as a part of our 1,000 farmers who we met with, we asked them, what is the kind of money per month you think you want to live a life based on dignity and for you to meet your essentials of life? So they said, the average came somewhere to about $100 a month. And that is good for them. And currently, they aren't able to make that reliably. So what we started doing is, keeping that $100 a month as the magic mantra, we started working backwards. How many plants should we have in a greenhouse so that the farmers can get X return and with so much of money, so much of price realization, farmers can get $100 of profit. So then we got to the size of greenhouse. Then we actually started working with fantastic design partners called Top Greenhouses. Now, what Mahindra Top Greenhouses has done for us is, they really understood what we want and what our farmers want, and they truly are our partners. So they actually started working very closely with our team on how to design for the poor, in terms of size, in terms of modularity. One of the most recent things that we have done is, earlier greenhouses always required concrete foundation, which in one sense limited the scalability of our model. But now, happy to share with you that we came up with a very unique model which doesn't require concreting for foundation. And it, if you want to pull out a pillar, you might have to probably put 20 elephants on the other side to pull that out. It's like so strong, but that kind of innovative design we could co-create.
That's amazing. you partnered with Stanford University as well, right?
Yeah, for a brief period, we actually worked with Stanford D School, where they were kind of doing a project with us.
Cool. So here in the United States, one thing that small farmers really struggle with are the subsidies from the government that support commodities like corn, wheat, and soy. So these small organic farmers who are creating nutritious, delicious food and a livelihood really struggle. Is there a similar parallel in India and why you're focusing on these smaller farmers?
Well, 80% of the food that you and I eat, whether you are sitting in the United States or whether I'm sitting in India, is grown by smallholder farmers.
I read that somewhere.
Right? So Now, if you want your food tomorrow morning, you better protect the interest of smallholder farmer today. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you wouldn't have food on your plate, as simple as that. So thinking about smallholder farmer is thinking about food security. So that's the reason why we went with the focus on smallholder farmers. And everything that we do is essentially for the small and marginal farmers. The other point that you spoke about regarding the subsidies, yes, even in India, there are a lot of subsidies that government gives away. What we are trying to do is we are showcasing to the farmers that without dependence on subsidies, in a market-based model, they can actually have access to these greenhouses. They can buy these greenhouses by taking a loan from one of our banking partners. And they can get a greenhouse on their farm and they can grow and they can earn repay loans. So it looks like a self-financing model in that sense over time. So we are essentially building a sustainable model, not just for ourselves, but also for the farmers.
Mm-hmm. Are the farms that you guys provide the greenhouses to all over India, or are there very specific locations where farmers struggle more than others?
So right now we work in a specific cluster, which is one of the fairly drought-prone and backward regions in India, which is called the Deccan Plateau. And we started off with that place, but over time, this would kind of go, or what this model would be replicated to many other regions in India and also to other parts of the world where smallholder farmers are struggling to get access to basic incomes.
Something else that I've thought about a lot when I was looking at your model and everything that you're providing is this idea that when we don't make enough money, our life is unpredictable. You know, we're not turning over the yields that we thought. We don't have any money. Life can get kind of depressing. And I read somewhere that the suicide rates of farmers was very high.
Hmm. So in India, statistics show that in every 42 minutes, there is a farmer who would have committed a suicide. So by the time you finish listening to this podcast, probably there is one who is gone. So that's unfortunate. And we saw in our state and in the Deccan Plateau region, particularly when I'm talking about it, kind of cuts across three to four states. And farmer suicides are so prevalent. And what happens to those families after that is a story for another day. Mm. It's just beyond comprehension. And the kind of impact on women, the impact on children, and, you know, there might be some grandparents. Because most of the people who commit suicide are men. So the core reason is, in India, if you take a 5 years average, 100 million smallholder farmers lose money from farming. They don't make money. They lose money from farming. It is so unviable. And that's all they know. They know just that. And what they know is not giving them money.
So how are you supposed to...
Yeah.
Wow.
And what's the rationale? I mean, how do they survive? And it's getting worse because now, when recently central government in India ran a survey, 90% of the farmers don't want their kids to come into farming, which is understandable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you want to put your kids into something which, you know, in which you struggled all through all your life? And 3 out of 4 farmers want to just quit farming today if they have an option, but they don't have one.
Because that's all they have.
That's all they
have. That's all they know.
Yeah.
That's their skill set.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that raises questions, not just on the farmer's survival, but it also raises larger questions on the global food security.
Mm-hmm.
Because India, I don't want people to just see India as a country. India is almost, in terms of population, 1/4 of the world. That should tell something. 1 out of every 4 people, you know, is living in India. So you can't say that I'll turn a blind eye to what's happening to that. And that's essentially the reason why this problem is important. It's urgent and we need to act on it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, food security is a huge problem. And I think it presents itself in different ways all over the world. I know some of the documentaries and things that I've seen about food security in the States is that we're overfed and undernourished. And I'm sure it presents itself maybe in a different way in India, but, you know, putting good food in our body and fueling our minds and how we live, especially for our children, is incredibly important. And, you know, you had this amazing discovery story of how you, you know, you're from your aha moment to talking with your co-founders, doing the discovery with the farmers, with an intended impact of helping raise people out of poverty using technology. But from our conversation, it feels like the impact that you're having is multifold. You know, I mean, I guess it has to do with the poverty cycle too, right? It's not just about being poor. There are so many different elements that go along with it. But not only are you addressing poverty, but you're addressing climate change. You're addressing food security. Were these all intended impacts when you started, or have they built over time?
Well, getting money into the hands of smallholder farmers is at the root of everything. And everything else, of course, so for that to happen, you need to make sure that the resources, like water particularly, are being used well. And they should get some protection from climate risk. And there should be climate, climate change related adaptation practices that we should get farmers to do. So these are intertwined. I don't think any effort in the world to eradicate poverty works, particularly in smallholder farmer segment, without having the lens of climate change, without having the lens of gender, without having the lens of, the overall prosperity of the family, right? So I think it's kind of intertwined. So while we might press one button and try to move the needle forward in that direction, it essentially moves many more things. And so we are kind of aware of that, but we have a long way to go before what all we are talking can reach 1 million farmers. So we are pretty early in our journey right now.
Mm-hmm. That's the goal, right? 1 million farmers by 2025?
Yeah, that's a dream.
Well, it sounds like a pretty amazing dream. And you must feel very proud of all the work that you've done, or you should.
Yeah, feel good about it. And we also feel impatient about it because, I think we should have done much better. We should have done much faster. So we haven't, honestly, if you ask me, I feel that we are much slower in our work than what I would love to see myself doing and our organization progressing. But sure, we are confident that we are in the right track and we'll get there.
That's great. I want to go back to, you mentioned the impact on gender.
Mm-hmm.
What's the discrepancy like men versus women in India working on these small farms? I know that your work does a lot to support women. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in India today, they say anywhere between 33% to 50% of the work in the fields is done by women. There are different conflicting statistics, so I'll not get into that, but you can have like a 1/3 to half of the total agricultural work which is done by women. But often what happens is women are always considered as farm labor, because if you just say farmer, the one who comes to your mind is a male farmer often. It's not a women farmer. The reality is there is a sizable population and sizable chunk of work in the world which is done by women farmers. That often goes as unpaid labor, or, you know, that's something unfortunate. And even in terms of the access to land resources, just about 10% of the total agricultural land is owned by women versus 90% being held by men. So there is very clearly a problem in the agriculture from gender lens. The greenhouses, what we are building, to operate them, we realize that women should operate the greenhouses. Step one, if women operate the greenhouses, it will work the best. Why? Women are the best, you know, are better than men in terms of learning new techniques. And that's proven with enough studies.
I'm gonna write that quote down for sure.
Please do. Right. And also, when it comes to behavioral change, women are more willing to change behaviors for good than men. So when we think of these, it makes a lot of sense to move a family out of poverty. It's important to empower the women. But what we failed in till now is the land is owned by men, and they get access to the mobile phone, and that makes decision making still largely dependent on men. So we are actually having this challenge in our organization, and also in our, you know, not just in our organization, also in many other organizations, that while we do want to do more to bring a better gender balance, it's not just for charity, but it really makes sense. I would want to emphasize on that.
Mm-hmm.
Our intentions are in that direction, but actually much more work should happen from our side and also from a lot of players, including government, on how the gender lens can be brought into reality and how we can operationalize gender lens. I think a lot of people just talk at high level about gender equality and they don't really talk about operationalizing it. It's important we talk about how do you get that into your day-to-day work. So I think that's something which we don't have a clear answer, but we are making kind of efforts in that direction. And the best thing is all the work in a greenhouse, a woman can do with just 1 hour of her time. That is it. Men may go and do work and kind of earn $100 a month from full day of work. By using our greenhouse, women can do every bit of work. It's so easy. It's not backbreaking. And just 1 hour of work. So that from that lens, I feel I'm quite excited that over time, this will be a good solution for women farmers, because you reality of the matter in India and most parts of the world is there is a lot of unpaid labor time which goes for women in taking care of the household chores, etc.
Right
now as we talk. Yes, they should change, but today as we talk, that is how it is. So with all of that, still getting $100 a month is something fantastic.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And I love what you say about operationalizing things. Things don't happen overnight, right? You can't just say you want something and have it happen. And it seems like that's how this whole process has gone for you and why it's been really successful. So before we close out, I want to understand, from start to finish, if I'm a farmer and I want one of these greenhouses, what does that look like? Because I know it's not simply the farmer does all the work, getting the loan on their own, then they go and they install it themselves, and then all of a sudden they're creating crops and marketing and things like that. So what does that process look like, and how do you support the farmers along the journey and then beyond?
Right. So you're my farmer for today.
I'm a farmer. Yes. Where I'm from in upstate New York, there are a lot of farms. So I could put on my farmer's hat.
Sure. So, but you should be a farmer who is a part of a farmer collective, a formal or informal farmer collective. So in India, we have a lot of these farmer collectives, so you should be a part of that first.
Okay.
Okay, so yes, please move to India.
As part of the farmer collective. Now, how do I do it?
Right. So, Kheti identifies the farmer collective, or farmer collective identifies Kheti, and we create an education camp in your village on how to grow vegetables in modern methods, and how can you make more money from your vegetable farming. So, we will conduct an awareness session in your village. Done. Now we completed our awareness session.
Okay, step one done.
Right. So once we do this awareness session, in which we actually talk about greenhouses and versus open field farming and all of that, there will be some farmers who want to come forward and say, hey, you know what? I'm interested to know more. So that is when we engage with the farmers to kind of arrange a field visit for them to a community of farmers who are already doing these greenhouses. So nothing like seeing a fellow farmer and hearing his or her experiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there would be knowledge sharing, information sharing, and experience sharing between these farmers. And then we get these farmers together, and we kind of, once they sign up, they make a down payment for the greenhouse, which generally is between $300 to $400. And after that, we help the farmers get loans from mainstream banks at really less and affordable rates of interest. So they just need to sign up, loan process, we help them with.
Mm-hmm.
Then the farmers need to get a greenhouse once the loan is approved. So loan is approved, now you're going to get your greenhouse installed on your field. So our manufacturing come installation partner would come and install these greenhouses. Great. So step one is done. You actually have greenhouse.
Yes.
Now.
Got my greenhouse.
Yes. You should feel proud.
I'm proud. I've got a greenhouse right. Ready to go.
And now you will have a two-day boot camp.
Oh, I don't know how long a boot camp.
Right. No. So there will be a boot camp on how to grow.
Okay.
This is super immersive. And this makes sure that you understand at least 80% of what you're supposed to do. Why is 80%? Is even after 2 days of boot camp, there might still be surprises. After all, it is agriculture and these are living beings, right?
Yes.
So 80% you're all set, and then you go. We help you get access to seeds, fertilizers. You get started with you kind of sow the seeds, you kind of start fertigating the plants, and your plants are growing. Are your plants growing?
My plants are growing. They're so beautiful. All the colors of the rainbow.
Fantastic. I think they should just be green.
Okay. Sorry. I'm only growing green vegetables.
Right. So the farmers, if they have a problem that they notice in the plants, call up on our hotline number. So that's a call center available to the farmers, and they call us up and they raise a ticket or we raise a ticket for them once they call us in. The problem has to get resolved by asking farmers a series of questions and sometimes asking farmers to send photos or videos of what they noticed. If the problem is not understandable just with these, generally it is, but if it is not, then one of our technical team members goes and visits that farmer. Which happens pretty rarely though, but yes, in exceptional cases even that happens, and sees exactly what's wrong and gives the right doses. So once the medicine or chemical that has to be used is prescribed to the farmer, there will be a mechanism for the farmer to get that locally from one of our local distribution partners. And we call them Kheti Walas, so basically farming fellows.
Okay.
Right. And then the farmers grow. The farmers, you know, we help farmers troubleshoot. Now, well, you must have the fruits ready on your plants. Do you find them?
I found them.
Right?
They're there. I'm a successful farmer.
Great. So now, to really make those fruits convert into money, you need to harvest them.
Oh.
So once you harvest them, our team picks them up from your village and sells them. You know, there is a way in which those fruits and vegetables get sold, and you would get money in your bank account.
Wow. I just saw it come through. A direct deposit.
Yeah, of course. Don't forget to repay your loan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, that part. No, and I feel that that last part is key. You guys picking up the fruits and the produce and selling it. Because yeah. if I'm a farmer and that's my skill, I might not know how to create that supply chain.
Yeah.
So that's very, very cool.
Yeah. So I think the real important thing in that is not just the logistics, but it's the market network.
Mm-hmm.
We should, you know, we help farmers, smallholder farmers, build that right market network, which improves their bargaining power. So they can ask for the price that they want and they should find a way to get a fair compensation for what they grow. So
yeah.
that's the piece that we work on in the last, with respect to markets. Yeah.
Awesome. That's so empowering for people who have not felt empowered in a long time.
Thank you.
It's really wonderful. What is next for Kathy? What are your goals?
Well, right now, Kathy is still in the R&D stage where the farmers with whom you're working right now, about 150 of them, are our early adopters. Till end of 2019, we would continue to be in our R&D stage and or R&D phase, as you would like to call it. After that, we would move into a replication stage where whatever we are doing right now, we want to see how that works when other businesses, other franchise partners, when they start doing this. Because how can we alone reach every farmer, you know, in the world? So we would be testing that out for 2 more years. And that is when, once we get that piece right, that's when we would start scaling it up. Well, the idea is, yes, we want to reach 1 million farmers by 2025.
How can we help you do that?
Well, I mean, this is an inspiring dream to have. And the kind of helping smallholder farmers succeed is our collective responsibility. Those who want to be a part of the, advisors or investors can be a part of this. Those who want to make a grant for it can actually do that. Those who want to, those who have special competence in, say, farming or market side networks can do that. So it's our collective responsibility. And if we all come together, we can make sure that no other smallholder farmer would ever eat mud.
I love that. I will be sure to include all of your links and contact information on the show notes for this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was such a inspirational and educational and really moving conversation. And I know you have a really busy schedule and so much work that you're doing. And I just really appreciate you sitting down and talking with me.
Well, pleasure was mine too. Thank you very much. I hope, you know, our voice and work reaches many more people. And we hope more good people, you know, get to work together for this cause, which is larger than all our lives.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Satya as much as I enjoyed having it. I don't know about you, but when he was telling me the story about when he was just 17 years old in his own village and saw a farmer eating mud, I was just blown away, so moved and inspired. If you'd like to learn more about the work that Satya and Katie are doing, you can visit my website, www.haley-miller.com/podcast, where I've included all of the show notes and the links to his work and the work of my other guests. You can also visit www.katie.com. Well, that's it for today. Thanks again so much for being here. It really means a lot. I'll see you back here, same day, same time next week.